Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian, from Brussels, where we've been spending time at NATO headquarters interviewing some of the alliance's top leaders. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And joining us to discuss the week in Washington are Byron Callen of the independent equity research firm Capital Alpha Partners in Washington, D.C. Byron, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
Gordon Adams, Professor Emeritus from American University and the Stimson Center, distinguished fellow. Gordon, always a pleasure having you on.
Glad to be here, Vago.
Former Pentagon Comptroller Bob Hale, who now advises Booz Allen Hamilton. He is also a fellow with the Center for a New American Security, and his views are his own. Bob, always good to have you on.
Thanks for the chance.
All right, guys, another sporty week. We have a House Armed Services Committee markup is finished. There are budget talks or budget cap talks that all eyes are on at a time when Democrats now have gone to court. So the relationship, certainly with the administration, is getting going from confrontational to even more confrontational. We've got the Paris Air Show next week in Le Bourget, which is always a highlight of the calendar. And one of the key themes and stories there is going to be the proposed merger between United Technologies and Raytheon. Bob, let me start with you to talk to us a little bit about the HASC mark and what it tells us about what's to come in this budget process.
Well, thanks, Vago. I think there's good news here in that Congress is moving ahead, even though the budget was late. We've now seen the Senate committee finish work on the authorization bill. The House actually passed an appropriation bill. And then the House Armed Services Committee completed a marathon markup just early this morning. They started at 10 a.m. Eastern Wednesday, finished at 7 a.m. Eastern today, almost 24 hours. I think the markup was characterized by some severe disagreements, partisan disagreements, more than is usual for this committee, including whether to deploy low-yield nuclear weapons. They decided, at least in this bill, to go forward, or not to, I'm sorry, whether to stick with the president's proposed $750 billion budget or go to 733. They stayed at 733. Whether to prohibit border wall funding, I believe they did leave in that prohibition and probably also some limits on how much money the department can move around during execution, so-called reprogramming. The bottom line is the bill passed by a largely partisan vote of 33 to 24, again, unusual for this committee, and probably means we got a lot of problems ahead. They may have trouble even getting through the House floor if the Republicans mostly vote against this bill and some of the liberal Democrats defect. They may not even get off the floor. And of course, there'll be a lot of contentious debate with the Senate trying to resolve the issue. So the good news is they're moving forward, but I still think that we got a long way to go in this debate, and it'll be probably late this year, calendar year, before it gets resolved. So with that, I'll stop and see if let my colleagues have a say.
Gordon, you're a longtime budget watcher. How do you see the situation?
Well, I think Bob's exactly right. It's going to be a long time before either the appropriations bills or the authorizing bills have been reconciled between the two chambers. I did find the repeat in the HASC bill of the limits on reprogramming that Bob mentioned a repeat, because the appropriators did exactly the same thing, reducing by some $7 billion or so the ability of the department to move money around. Now, I don't necessarily expect that to survive conference, but we're a long way from conference. And even if you're compromising, it could cut back on the flexibility the department has. So we're waiting, I think, on a defense bill for the larger issue to resolve itself.
Byron, you've been watching this process pretty closely and talking to your sources both in Washington as well as on the street. Talk to us about what your take is, because you've written a whole series of thoughtful notes on both what's happening but also what's to come.
Well, I mean, I think if you look at the numbers, you know, there's not a sea of difference between the two. I would agree with Bob's observations. This, listening to some of it yesterday, I did not stay up all night last night, but you know, there were some edges to this, which is unusual for a committee that really had prided itself on bipartisanship. So, and I agree that's going to get amplified as this moves through the House. And certainly, you know, it's going to be interesting when it hits conference how this is going to be reconciled with the Senate version. You know, if I look even now at the differences between the Senate Armed Services Committee, Mark, as they did release their full text, I guess, yesterday, you know, on they're pretty much the same on O&M. I think they both came around about $256 billion, $257 billion. There is a difference in investment. And by investment, I mean the sum of procurement and RDT&E. I think HASC came out around $242 billion. SASC a little bit higher, and their authorization about $250 billion. You know, there are differences if you go kind of in the you know, guts of different program changes. But I wouldn't think that there's anything that's really, you know, one could make the case that this is a dire blow to national security, or, you know, that you're going to fix all the defense problems by coming up at the SASC mark. So I think this, you know, this remains a must pass piece of legislation. I think it will get done. It has to get done. When remains the issue. And like a lot of things in Washington, D.C., I think, you know, kind of the last minute will be the appropriate place to mark in the calendar.
How does the whole suing the administration on the House side of things, obviously Republicans are decrying everything that Democrats do as partisan, apparently forgetting that every single time a Democratic administration has been in office, the Republicans have done, I think, some pretty extraordinary hyper-partisan work to try to stymie whatever that administration is, whether it was the Clinton administration or the Obama administration in particular. How are all of these other facts, you know, so far it hasn't affected defense, or has it, or will it? And if not, why not?
Well, Vago, let me bridge that thought just by pointing out that the politics are even more complicated here than you think. If this partisanship over the defense bill persists, and I expect it to, on the floor and in the conference, what it means for the Democrats in the House is they really have to stay unified on the number. This disagreement about whether it's $750 billion or $733 billion will, I have no doubt, come to the floor. And in order to pass the bill on the floor, you know, the Speaker and Adam Smith are going to have to hold virtually all of the Democrats, which gives some leverage politically on the broader set of issues to the more progressive caucus in the Democratic Party, who don't like even the 733 number. So it could affect the defense bill. That takes us to the bigger politics of the budget, which we talk about repeatedly. We see basically no progress at this point in terms of a deal on changing the caps. And I don't see much prospect for that coming. And it takes us, I think, into the heart of the question you asked, which is, how does the larger political fracas between the Democrats in the Congress and, I would say, a weakening but not yet visible Republican unhappiness about Trump and the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue that could, you know, very easily get stuck. And a lot of things like budget, like debt ceiling, like the defense bill, could get sucked into the vortex of those politics over the next couple, 3 months.
Anything you guys want to add on this theme?
I'm not ready. I think what I'm hearing from Gordon is he's probably a little more pessimistic. I don't know if that's a fair characterization, Gordon. If you're more pessimistic about how this whole process plays out based on what's happened this week, I'm kind of still sitting pat in the same place. Maybe I might get a lot more pessimistic by the September timeframe. And I really do think, look, there was an event earlier this past week with a couple of the senior House and Senate leadership, notably Yarmuth from the House Budget Committee had talked about the fact that there really could have been a budget deal on the caps done by now if it was just House and Senate GOP and Democrat leadership negotiating this. He felt that what had really changed was the White House involvement in this. And what I think is going to be some real brinkmanship on the part of the White House you know, on the basis that they think they're going to get some leverage out of this, out of these budget negotiations. I'm not sure that's the case. And I think it was Yarmouth who made the point that, you know, Mitch McConnell's up for re-election in 2020. He probably doesn't want to, you know, stare into 2020, late 2019 with a broken budget process and having nothing done, with all the uncertainty that may accompany further shutdowns, all the other things that could make him vulnerable for re-election. So I'm not ready to become more pessimistic today, but I've got my eye on the door.
Hold on. Let me test this a little bit. I mean, understanding, you know, Byron, you're apolitical. I'm apolitical. Gordon, I think, is a proud Democrat. And Bob, I think you're a proud Democrat as well. But both of you have certainly advised all manner of governments. But both of you served in Democratic administrations. So I think we know where you guys come at this politically. I mean, does anybody, especially Mitch McConnell, think that anything he's doing is hurting his reelection chances? I mean, I think he comes from a state where I mean, he wouldn't be doing what he's doing if he didn't think it played well back home. And he's the president's man in Congress and benefiting from a lot of outside money that he's always been able to count on. So why would anybody think that Mitch McConnell would be vulnerable?
I frankly don't think Mitch McConnell's running scared, at least not yet. And I don't see him being primaried on the right.
If he gets primaried on the right, I think he's going to fare pretty well.
I think he will do quite fine. I have, you know, strong expectations, you know, whatever anybody thinks of his leadership, that he will be restored. And, you know, after all, any state that has the Senate majority leader as its senator is doing well. If Chuck Schumer, the majority leader, he'd do exceedingly well in New York, he would anyway. But it's really a question of how the pieces fit together for me. I'm not sure that I would agree with Byron that, you know, I'm pessimistic or optimistic. I suppose I would say trying to be realistic, because I think the parameters of possibilities here are extremely broad. And with the politics of investigation proceeding, with a Republican caucus in the Senate that is increasingly restive about what the administration is doing in tariffs and Mexico and the like, and beginning just at the edge of speaking out about that, it's not something that the president can automatically count on anymore. And with the fractures in the Democratic Party in the House, making it necessary for either Adam Smith at the committee level or Nancy Pelosi at the speaker level, have to deal with how to negotiate both, the hearings and investigations and getting that budget deal done. I just think the parameters are very broad, and the chance that this could slip off the rails into a more serious political confrontation are real. I'm not saying they're going to happen, but I think we know less with less certainty what is going to happen.
Bob or Byron?
All of this tells me that it's going to take a crisis to force some agreement on the part of the three parties. The debt ceiling will probably be the first crisis. I think it'll come. We'll hit up against it hard, probably in the fall. But by the time we get to the end of the year, we'll be facing conceivably a sequestration that would be devastating for defense. I don't think either we're not going to breach the debt ceiling, and I don't think we're going to go through sequestration or a shutdown. I think there'll be a deal, but it'll be late, and it's going to require a crisis and a lot of messy negotiations before it occurs.
And now a word from our sponsor. The Defense and Aerospace Report is brought to you by the Bell V-280 Valor, bringing the mission technology of the future to the battlefield of today. Visit bellflight.com for more. Joining us now for this portion of the conversation is one of the folks on our team, Chris Cervello, retired United States Navy commander, former Navy spokesman and spokesman for the Chief of Naval Operations, and a graduate of the United States Naval Academy in Annapolis. Chris, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Vaga.
All right. So I want to get everybody's bite at this apple, but you've been talking to your former colleagues in the building about these new explosions that have apparently racked two tankers. At least that was the report earlier today, one of which may have been abandoned by its crew. Bring us up to speed on what's happened there and what folks in the building think has happened to those ships.
Big picture, what I gathered from talking to a number of former colleagues, both with the Navy and in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, pretty definitive from their standpoint that it was Iran or at least proxies associated with the Iranian government. They believe it to be magnetic mines that caused the explosions. There was some reporting that they may have been torpedoes, but they're pretty confident that it was magnetic mines and that it looks very similar to the activities of a week or so ago. Five tankers had similar damage below the waterline, although there were not explosions. And then they are particularly concerned about how the markets are reacting. In addition to the international security implications of this, the market reactions and the sudden increase in the price of oil has their attention. There are two Navy ships that were sent to that in that direction, both destroyers, the Bainbridge and the Mason. And there is Navy and Air Force reconnaissance support just to be able to get a better sense of what's going on in the area. And then finally, the carrier Lincoln got underway this morning from Amman. That was a previously planned underway, but the Lincoln has canceled the planned exercise that it had with the French carrier Charles de Gaulle so that it could be available should naval activity from either the Lincoln or its escort ships be necessary.
So, Byron, let me first go to you in terms of, you know, market reaction. Any market reaction?
Well, I mean, oil's up a bit. The broader stock market is up. I mean, I think the most interesting thing, and the defense stocks are really mixed today. So, you know, the market, frankly, you know, oil markets are paying attention to this. I'm not sure the broader markets are yet. I think, you know, the most interesting thing about, you know, this particular round of incidents, not just the tankers, but there was a cruise missile strike on a Saudi airport yesterday in about 300 kilometers from Sana'a in Yemen. The most interesting thing about these particular incidents is they come during, you know, the visit of Prime Minister Abe to Iran. And, you know, Iran kind of, if you look at all the reports, they really kind of rolled out the red carpet for him. So I don't know. I still think we're in an escalatory phase here. I don't know where this is going to go. I wrote about it. I mean, there are multiple paths this could take, but not a lot of them look real good right now.
Gordon, give us your take, because I think you have been understandably skeptical about, and you made that clear. But talk to us about your sense of where we are and where we're going.
Well, in the broader relationship between Iran, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, the United States, who are, you know, big players in the confrontations of the last couple of months, there is an ample amount of, let's say, cross-fertilized provocation going on, probably on both sides, and this may be part of it. I'm a little more reluctant. I don't have Chris's sources in the building, but I'm a little more reluctant to immediately characterize the nature of this and the responsibility for this on information that is less than 24 hours old without any particular analysis on the ships. There may be patterns that look the same, but I'm going to remain skeptical about the sources of this. There are ample opportunities for provocation here. There are people who want each other to hold coats while they fight. This is a tinderbox of a situation. And in a tinderbox, any country can make a mistake. And that includes everybody in the region and those with forces in the region, which means us. There are some people itching for a fight here and some people not itching for a fight here. And those are tinderbox situations.
I understand what Byron is saying, because, right, I mean, presumably, Byron, the point you're going to is that, you know, Iran really needs Shinzo Abe. So why would it do an attack like this at a time when the prime minister that they would like to have aboard, certainly for, you know, JCPOA or anything else, you know, at least an international power to at least have slightly in Iran's or helping Iran make its, case?
I'll give credit. You know, Atlantic Council held a June 13th kind of a quick reaction call to some of this stuff. And I think some of the people there correctly pointed out that if you want to send a message to Abe, because he was really delivering a message from Trump, you know, on let's get together, let's try and figure this out. That's minor. That was rejected out of hand. At the same time, you know, these kind of incidents may create more pressure to resolve this issue one way or another, that you know, U.S. unilateral withdrawal from JCPOA, and then imposing all these sanctions, you know, this is the answer to some of this stuff. And it's maybe they, you know, and at the same time, they can kind of say, well, you know, there was another story I saw where there was actually one of the Iranian government officials was saying, well, now maybe it's time to start talking about, you know, kind of a regional discussion about what's going on. So, and I did see, you know, there were some Iranian reports, I don't know if these have been verified elsewhere, that they had picked up, like, they had rescued the two crews from these tankers. There was film footage and social media, you know, Iranian helicopter over one of these burning ships. So it's complicated as always. I just don't know, for me, you know, is there an escalatory step that takes place here? You know, are we back to kind of the tanker wars and Operation Praying Mantis? You know, and in this kind of environment, if there's a quiet set of measures that are taken, that might be good in resolving the issue. But, you know, this is an inflammatory situation, and it could be very different than Operation Praying Mantis late 1980s. I think that was April 1988 or 1987.
I think you've got your dates right. And I want to bring Chris in a moment. But I mean, just one point to make, right? Historically, great powers have taken advantage of situations, right? I mean, the Turner Joy and the Maddox, turns out, may never have been shot at, and they were causes belli for the Vietnam War. The Germans staged a Polish attack on a German radio station to get World War II underway. So, I mean, all of these things have a tendency of happening, and the fact that Iranian helicopters showed up to rescue crews doesn't mean that Iran may not have been somehow involved in this.
Right, and I'll just add this, you know, as much as we're talking about this, you know, from a broader standpoint, you've had some pretty interesting develops in Hong Kong in the last 24, 48 hours, some mass protests that's gotten China on edge. And I think you've yet to see, you know, how Russia may react to an announcement that we're going to be stationing more troops in Poland, and Trump's comments that he might go after Nord Stream 2 and try and sanction Germany on this. So this is all part of the stew where I think on one hand we talk about the budget and the budget environment in Washington, D.C., but then you have all these other geopolitical things swirling around. And I really grapple with this kind of yin and yang between the D.C. budget picture and a very volatile, combustible international environment.
The one counterpoint is, you know, we are backing away from JCPOA, and the Iranians have a variety of levers at their disposal in order to make sort of their view felt, whether it's backing away from nuclear enrichment or whether, you know, mobilizing proxy forces to deliver a blow or two here or there that are unambiguously interpreted. The timing of it may be very bad, but I mean, Lon Berman of the American Foreign Policy Council, who sadly couldn't join us today, you know, that's one of the points that Ilan would make, having, you know, talked to a lot of people on all sides about that. But Gordon, you were saying, and Chris, I haven't forgotten about you because I want to bring you into this, but go ahead, Gordon.
Yeah, just one thought, building off of what Byron was just saying. The French ambassador just delivered a parting letter to the United States on his way out the door back to Paris, the ambassador to the U.S., basically saying, time to wake up. The power relationships around the globe have changed, and it really requires some adaptation by the powers that be that can't use the previous operating prejudices. What strikes me in this particular situation is that the United States, it seems to be stating the obvious, but the United States does not control all the actors here. The United States does not control the Saudis. It doesn't control the UAE. It does not control the players in this process. It has certainly played a role in stimulating anger on the Iranian side of the equation. The Iranians don't control the actors here. They have stimulated a sense of crisis. What's really important to keep in mind about this process is our just doing something, we being the United States, does not make this very fractious power distribution in the region go away. It makes it a lot more complicated to find the answer.
Chris, give us your sense on sort of the scenario planning the Navy is doing right now, because in the event that it has to respond, obviously the service is going to have to respond very, very quickly. That's one of the advantages of naval forces, but it's also one of the things the Navy prides itself on, is the ability to improvise on the fly, including some very complex operations. What are the sort of calculations folks at Fifth Fleet are now making in the AOR in the event that things turn rather rapidly?
Complexities that Byron and Gordon and you have laid out all of those aside, this is what the ships in Fifth Fleet train for pretty much every day, whether they're preparing to go on deployment or they're in the Fifth Fleet AOR. What they will be concerned about is the high tempo of Iranian naval activity, particularly the Revolutionary Guard naval activity, the small boat activity that's around this area has been reported throughout the morning. They'll keep a close eye on that. They do have the crew of one of the motor vessels on board, so they'll be looking to make sure that they're stabilized and get them off of the Bainbridge and to somewhere safe so that they can figure out what happened by talking to the crew. And then it's just about options, right? I mean, everything from as rudimentary as making sure that traffic continues to flow unharmed to whatever sort of response scenario CENTCOM and the president may deem necessary. So from a purely naval standpoint, you're right. I mean, this is why you want forward deployed naval forces. This is why you want to train to this type of scenario. From that standpoint, it's pretty pretty basic and pretty standard in terms of what we've trained for. It gets much more complex as you start to introduce all of the other scenarios that you just talked about.
And we should be clear that certainly naval aircraft, as well as the U.S. Air Force, for example, has been in coordinating proximity with Russian forces as they were in Syria, right? So even though we can sometimes get into close contact, we can still be constructive. And from the Iranian standpoint, I don't think there's been any statement about, closing the Gulf or any of that at this point. Okay, clearly stuff we've got to keep an eye out on. Bob, did you want to add anything to this naval discussion as a former naval person?
Let us bring back to the defense budget for a moment. There's ample history that suggests that the top line of the U.S. defense budget is driven by significant threats to U.S. security. Probably not there yet to a significant threat, but if this escalates, I think it will clearly tend to favor the Republicans' view of going to 750 in fiscal 20 defense.
Do you think, for example, if the president makes a major troop deployment, not that he would, but if there's already been an increased amount of activity in the region, if we decide to move some folks to the area, as the president has suggested, that would also mean a bigger supplemental number, wouldn't it?
Well, it would, but I think the department, absent a huge war that caused us to send 100,000 troops over there or something like that, I think the department's going to have to eat this one because it would be too difficult to get a supplemental, which requires, of course, a vote of both houses and the signature of the president, too difficult to get it through in this environment. So I think DOD's on the hook, and if I were their comptroller right now, I'd be worried about my O&M budget and how it could be affected by all of this.
Yeah, and I would just, the counterpoint to that is I think it would really introduce a very interesting element into the 2020 election, which has largely been about domestic issues. And, how did we get to this state of affairs today? What's going on with some of these other geopolitical issues? And I think there could be a counterpoint to that. It might be a short-term positive for defense if you have to replace munitions and maybe you get the 750 number, but there could be some very different outcomes if we get involved in another, if this is kind of a rerun of 2003, and you get involved in something that's very long and messy, and the public may turn against some of that.
Well, so let me ask about the messiness of this. The administration said that it was going to use emergency war powers, or rather the president did, was going to use emergency powers to authorize arms sales to Saudi Arabia, eight deals, including precision weapon technology the United States tends to guard closely. We've seen Lindsey Graham, one of the president's closest allies, a one-time critic, but now a bosom buddy, get in there and say that he's not crazy about that. Are we seeing a different dynamic when it comes to giving the president the kind of free hand that he's wanted, especially when it comes to Saudi Arabia and the UAE? And anybody at all can grab that?
Well, I think, yes. And I think the question is, it really depends how careful the Iranians are. These are, to me, and again, I know Gordon may have a different view on this, but if you presume these are Iranian and Iranian proxy forces, they're operating just below this threshold. They haven't taken a shot at U.S. Navy ships or, for example, the base in Bahrain or facilities in Qatar or UAE or, for that matter, naval vessels at sea. So that would be a very different dynamic if that's where this thing goes. But if you have a major escalatory action on the part of the U.S. that then results in an Iranian response and this thing spirals upward, I don't know. I think we're kind of in an environment where, foreign policy has been absolutely absent from a lot of the Democrats' positioning so far in kind of how they're running their 2020 campaigns. It'll be interesting if it comes up in the debates, I think, on the week after next, the first round of Democrat debates. So I don't know. I just put that out as a variable for people to ponder.
Yeah, but I see the point you're trying to make, Byron. But ultimately, the president's base, right, the president's popularity is, I think, higher now than it's been in a long time. And I think for folks in his base, he's standing up to Iran. Iranians are bad guys. Ronald Reagan dealt with Iran. You know, we've got to show him what's what. I think is something that plays well to his base, isn't it? I mean,
I don't know, Vago. I mean, I personally think if you're in a situation in the summer of 2020 where, once again, you know, we're not going to have infrastructure, we're not going to address healthcare, we're not going to address jobs, training, we're not going to address all the other things that I think people have wanted in odd ways, because you're spending another, you know, $50-100 billion a year on an open-ended campaign. We're not going to put ground troops in there, but I mean, I just think it could create a different dynamic. And sure, it will appeal to the Trump base, but I saw some matchup polls this week where, you know, on the leading Democratic candidates, Trump was kind of in a consistent 32%. Now, those are national polls. You really have to get down to state-by-state stuff, but I'm not so sure that people are ready for another, and I think Trump recognizes this too, in his criticism on Iraq and Afghanistan, and even the way he's handled North Korea. I don't think he wants to get involved in a large open-ended conflict, but, you know, the ingredients potentially are there with Iran.
We're facing a situation where Wag the Dog could play here, but with Trump's base is not uniformly a let's go to war base. There was a lot in 16, which was basically saying, let's not go to war. Let's stop these endless wars. Let's pull out of other people's business. Mindful or mindless, whether you think it's one or the other, that's who they were. And on the Democratic side, there will be a very broad range of opinion in the Democratic presidential debate of the next couple of weeks, about ranging from Biden to Sanders, who are going to take very different positions on this issue. Sanders has already been very clear about what he sees and has described as provocative actions by the administration and the lack of desire in his base to go to war. I think we're likely to have a broader debate about this than a rallying around the flag.
We're a little bit long on the show. We've got a couple of things, so we're going to go to lightning round to hit the horn of other story elements. Bob, do you think ultimately whether Lindsey Graham thinks arms sales to Saudi Arabia is a bad thing, that A, signals any broader political shift in the Republican support for the president? And second, does it change the vector of the administration's arms sales to the region at all?
I think it's no to both. I understand his concerns and probably share them, but the fact is there are not enough votes to enforce his concerns. It's only a handful of Republicans at this point, and Trump would veto any legislation, and I think they surely couldn't override it. No more, they weren't able to override his desire to take DOD money for the border wall either. I think Trump is going to get his way on this one. But I do think we're missing a broader point in terms of the conflict with Iran. Yes, if it turns into a long major war, it would certainly affect the election. More importantly, will it have adverse effects on the economy? And if it caused a further slowdown in what is already an economy that appears to be slowing, that I think could be the big danger for Trump and re-election.
Chris, I want to go to you, and then I want to get everybody's views on this. Story broke, NBC wrote it, that the president appears to be cooling on Pat Shanahan, the acting defense secretary. Everybody and the president has sort of put the intent to nominate him as the next defense secretary, but there were reports that the president was asking folks during the D-Day celebrations, or rather I should say the 75th anniversary commemorating the D-Day landings, was asking folks what they thought about Shanahan. How do you perceive that story? How do you all perceive the story? Do you guys think that that's just a flash, or is that something that perhaps signifies that Pat Shanahan's days would be numbered, even though I think he's served his boss very, very well?
The team that broke this story has a real solid reputation for getting these types of things correct. And if we weren't in the midst of a potential crisis, that may be a little overkill, but if we weren't in the midst of an issue with Iran, I would say perhaps this is the president being the president. But given what's going on in Iran, I'm less likely to believe that Acting Secretary Shanahan is out. I think the president's going to be forced to stick with him as his nominee.
And before we part, Byron, two questions. One, an update on how the United Technologies Raytheon deal is being received on the street. Companies obviously putting together what would be the largest defense and aerospace transaction in certainly a long time to give the new Raytheon Technologies a beefier defense component as well as a commercial aerospace component. How's the street responding to the deal? And also, give us your sense on what some of the key topics, the key themes and the key stories we're going to see at the Paris Air Show next week.
Well, I mean, the simple answer to the deal is not well at all. If you look at the way the stock prices have reacted, you know, Raytheon is down probably, I have to check, but probably in the high single digits from before the deal being announced. United Technology has stabilized a little bit, but I think there are a lot of questions about what's the rationale for this really. I don't think people were impressed with the case that management made about research and development. I think there's a very elemental issue to this, which is if you believe in great power competition, you kind of have to ask yourself, why is a defense contractor that's making a lot of weapon systems that are going to be aimed at Chinese military capabilities, why are you merging with a commercial aerospace company that in part is going to derive its future sales and profits from products that are going to end up in China? If I'm the Chinese, why would I support, you know, buying that kind of product if it's going to be, you know, recast and turned against me? So I think there are problems here. You know, the management's kind of segueing into Paris Air Show. I think United Technologies is doing an investor meeting on Monday to kind of kick off the show. You know, Raytheon will be over there talking to investors. You know, obviously that's going to be one element of the show that I think is going to be important. The other, I think, is going to be where the European fighter programs are, the Franco-German program, the SCAF, and then what UK has to say or update on Tempest. There's an interesting heavy lift helicopter competition in Germany. And of course, you know, just what are the prospects for F-35? There was some news today that Switzerland, or that Saab had withdrawn from the Swiss fighter competition. So, you know, what a Dassault and BAE Systems and Airbus and Lockheed, Boeing say about the prospects that may change from that particular competition.
Guys, thanks very much for joining us. We really appreciate it. Byron Callen of Capital Alpha Partners, Bob Hale, former Pentagon comptroller, and now advises Booz Allen Hamilton, Gordon Adams, Professor Emeritus from American University, and Chris Cervello, who is on the Defense and Aerospace Report team, former Navy Public Affairs Officer. Guys, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Vago.
Glad to be here.
And thanks to all of you for joining us this week. Please follow our daily video interviews with top government, military, industry, and thought leaders at Defense and Aerospace Report, and subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Check out our coverage from NATO's new headquarters in Brussels and from the Paris Air Show next week. Follow us on Twitter at Def Aero Report. That's at DefAero Report. And like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report. The Defense and Aerospace Report podcast is sponsored by Bell. For more than 80 years, Bell has pushed past the boundaries of what's possible to drive aviation forward, going above and beyond flight, bellflight.com. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you next week.